Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Actually get you to start by reading the very first paragraph.
You bet.
And because this is on tape, if you stumble at all, just stop, start over, we will edit.
Awesome.
Okay.
The mouth is a weird place. Not quite inside and not quite out, not skin and not organ, but something in between, dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate, where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up.
That is great. Josh, the narrator in your novel is a dentist named Paul O'Rourke, and I have to ask, of all the professions in the world, why did you choose to write about a dentist?
Well, he's not the first thing that came to mind, for sure. It took a little while. You know, I think figuring out what a character does, for me, it kind of makes him honest. You know, I'm perfectly happy reading a book and hearing about a neurosurgeon or a truck driver and never circling back to seeing them actually do the neurosurgery or the truck driving. But for my characters, I feel like they come alive when I set them to work.
Hmm.
A dentist is a troubled guy, usually. I think of them as kind of aggrieved because the world tends to ignore their requests and exhortations, you know?
And they certainly don't have the status of doctors.
No, they don't. But they still have the same kind of wisdom and important messages to convey, you know? I mean, there's a lot of good health tips that you can get from a dentist.
And I suppose if you're looking for metaphors, you know, decay and rot are right around the corner.
Yeah, I like those because they got me, you know, when I had a patient come in and be tended to Paul O'Rourke, he just could not avoid decay, rot, mortality, all the things I sort of wanted to talk about with respect to this book. So it was just, it was really convenient. And it also got him to do a lot of things, you know, which made the fiction more fun.
Hmm. Now, you said that you like to ground your fiction in work. I mean, and basically people who work in offices.
Yeah.
Why is that so important?
Well, I suppose I tend to go in that direction because that was where my professional life was spent. But I also feel like it does a lot of fictional work really quickly. So, say if I write cubicle, stapler, and water cooler, you know exactly where I am. And you pretty much believe it. So I can kind of do what it is that I will do with the fiction. And it's more believable than if I had to sort of construct the whole world, or at least more efficient.
Hmm. How would you describe Paul O'Rourke, the dentist, in your story?
Well, he's a little at odds with the world. He's a little aggrieved at various things. He should be very happy.
He's very successful, a successful dentist on the Upper East Side of New York.
He's a fine dentist. He's making a lot of money. He should be relaxed. He should enjoy his comforts, but he just can't. He can't get along with the people in his office, not through really any fault of their own. He is made constantly aware of the forces at play on people because they come in with mouths wrecked in accidents and neglected mouths and cavities that simply refuse to be filled. And he's just on alert at all times at the way in which the world is working against him and his deeper wishes. And so he's a little lost. He's adrift and doesn't really feel like he belongs anywhere. And as such, he gets a lot of his animus from complaint.
Well, in my sense is he's more than just a little adrift. If you sort of poke beneath the surface of Paul O'Rourke, there's a kind of existential panic there. There's a sense that, it doesn't add up. I mean, there's no kind of underlying purpose to his life.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he's looking for something and does not know what that is. And he's also an avowed atheist, so he has no real option in terms of a deep religious community. And from the separation from that makes him even more anxious than he might ordinarily be.
Are these personal questions for you? I mean, these questions of meaning and purpose and, you know, I don't know, if you wake up in the middle of the night wondering what it's all about?
Yeah, unfortunately, I wake up in the middle of the night every night. I can't seem to have a continuous sleep like I used to have as a boy, you know, when those sleeps were uninterrupted by whatever's going on in the brain. So I wake up and I do have a few questions for myself and for others. And that's always the worst time to ask questions. So some of the things that are circulating through Paul's mind also circulate through mine. But there is a difference because, generally speaking, I think as a person, I'm fairly content. And he's not. He's when he wakes up at night, everything seems to go against him.
Hmm. The questions about faith and religion run throughout this book. And Paul, as you mentioned, is an atheist, but he seems to be fascinated by religion, and he seems to kind of pine for people of faith who belong to a religious community. I mean, he sort of like he wishes he could do that, but because he doesn't believe in God, he can't. Does that resonate for you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I'm like a white guy, right? I'm just sort of a white male by all appearances, a WASP, I suppose. So I'm kind of welcome anywhere, but I belong nowhere. And when I was coming out of college, or when I went into college, I saw from the outside in for the first time a lot of subcultures, and some of them religious, some of them not. But I did long for some kind of connection on a deeper level that I had never had.
And so you did not grow up religious?
I grew up sort of religious. We were kind of, you know, the thing about the Christianity from which I came was all you really had to do was profess your faith. You just sort of had to declare that you believed in God, and then you were saved. You didn't have to do much, you know? So in an interesting way, this was sort of like an orthodoxy, you know, a singularity of belief. And what I liked about other religions was a kind of orthopraxy. The way in which they practice was very different from that. So the practice of religion, as I saw it in others, in Catholics and in Jews and in friends of mine who belonged to other religions, they were practicing that religion. They were enacting it, either on a weekly or even a daily basis. And while that seemed like a big fuss to me, it also seemed to come with some serious dividends.
So you sort of like there was a part of you that wished you could go there.
But, yeah, absolutely.
But maybe, I don't know, intellectually you couldn't?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I probably share some atheistic tendencies with Paul. Actually, I think more appropriate than anything, I share Connie, his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend's opinion that she's a non-practicing atheist. I tend to think that there's no God, but I also want to kind of bracket that belief so that I'm open to something should it come along.
Well, you have a passage in the book where you sort of reflect on these questions of atheism and belief, and I'm wondering if you could read that.
Sure. The most unfortunate thing about being an atheist wasn't the loss of God and all the comfort and reassurance of God, no small things, but the loss of a vital human vocabulary. Grace, charity, transcendence, I felt them as surely as any believer, even if we differed on the ultimate cause, and yet I had no right words for them. I had to borrow those words from an old dead order. And so while it was not a word I used, when I fell in love with Connie and became acquainted with the Plotzes, I felt blessed.
That's good. Thanks. Now, if Paul does have a religion, it would seem to be the Boston Red Sox. He is an obsessed Red Sox fan. He's a loner, so every night he goes home and he watches a tape of a Red Sox game that he's recorded on his VCR. Are you a Red Sox fan?
I was when I was a kid. Yeah, when I followed baseball, I was a Red Sox fan.
And is it fair to sort of make this connection to religious faith? I mean, for the true sports fan?
Oh, I think so, right? I mean, a lot of the avid sports fans that I know would be far more crazy in battle than any of the religious fanatics that I know.
Really? I mean, play that out for me. I mean, what are the connections that you see?
Well, I think in terms of the sheer devotion, there's, you know, kind of an entire life can be dedicated to a sport and to a team. And I think that that's one measure of, you know, adherence. And then there's the interesting thing that a Red Sox fan will do about a Yankees player, or a Yankees fan will do about a Red Sox player, in which they sort of willfully deny the facts and claim that that player is rotten or even criminal, despite no real objective proof of that or evidence of that, which seems to be a similar to certain religious claims.
It's sort of like, you know, it's not your tribe, so you're going to hate everyone in
the
other tribe.
That's right, and slander them and reduce them to criminals until they have been destroyed. As Paul practices the religion of baseball, he has certain rituals that he undergoes. He refuses to watch the sixth inning. He tapes every game. He can't watch the game in real time unless he watches it from the very first bat. So,
why does he skip the sixth inning?
Well, as Connie asks, why not? Or as he replies to Connie, rather, why not? It's, as he also says, it's, you know, it's bad luck not to be superstitious.
No, it would seem that being a Red Sox fan is complicated in this day and age. I mean, for so long, for so many years, they were the losers. You know, they could never get to the World Series, and they were kind of lovable because of that.
Yeah.
And then they broke through. They had that miraculous comeback against the Yankees, the hated Yankees, went on to win the World Series, and they became successful. And I'm wondering if it's not the same thing being a Red Sox fan anymore. Has the mystique gone away?
Well, you would have to ask a more dyed-in-the-wool Red Sox fan than me, but I have to think not. There was such an extraordinary amount of identity wrapped up in those 86 years that when the texture of the team changed by a single World Series win, what happened to some of those determined losers? The interesting thing about the Red Sox and how they differ from the Cubs is that they, you know, the Red Sox were always potential winners. And it was the potential that always caused the heartbreak.
They weren't just bad. I mean, they almost won
several
the big thing,
times,
but they never could quite do it.
They could never quite do it. So what happens to them when, I would think that a couple of fans, at least a couple, were out there around 2005, spring training of 2005, thinking, what have we done? What have we done to ourselves? Be careful what you wish for.
I'm trying to think if there's a religious analogy here, but
well, the religious analogy is fairly easy. I mean, it's a little facile, perhaps, but you know, for 2,000 years, the Jews had been kicked out of Jerusalem, and then in 1947, they get a state of their own, and since then, they've had to contend with forces that, historically speaking, they never had to before. So, I was thinking of the similarities between the Jews and the Red Sox when writing the book.
No, the central event that happens in this story is that Paul's professional identity is stolen. Someone comes along, makes a website, pretends that it is about Paul's dental practice, and it's not. Tell us what happens.
Well, he's not just an avowed atheist. He's very determined to stay off the internet, despite the fact that he can't get enough of his iPhone. So when he discovers that somebody has made an entire homepage for his dental practice, he's really flummoxed. It's not something that happens every day. And he also feels deeply violated. The picture of him on the about page is surveillance grade. It makes him look like he's wanted by the FBI. So he's very confused. And naturally, he needs to set out to find out who's done this to him and why. And that sort of sets him on the path toward discovering that he may or may not belong to an ancient religion. And he's got to determine not only if this religion is real, but if he, in fact, is a member of it.
What's the ancient religion?
It's called the Alms.
Which is, in your story, it's based on an actual tribe in the Bible, right?
That's right. It is generated from the Ohms as a people are generated from the Amalekites in the Hebrew Bible. The Amalekites are the ancient sworn enemy of the Israelites. And once they go from being the Amalekites to the Ohms, in a very similar way to the way in which the Israelites became the Jews at some point, they change their theology entirely and become something that an atheist like Paul may find intriguing.
So you've created this new religion, Ohmism, right?
I have. It's sweeping the nation as we speak.
Was that fun to do?
It was both fun and tedious, you know. I mean, how do you take a theology and a people and a culture and put it into a novel without being didactic? That was a real challenge, you know, and I failed for a long time. It's not a master class in theology, right? It's still a novel. It needs to work in accordance with the pleasures of the novel. So while it was a lot of fun to invent and sort of dream up this thing, figuring out how to make the particulars work within the novel, the form of the novel, was a tall order. I'm glad I don't have to do it again.
So why? I mean, what made you want to sort of invent this kind of this sort of fringe religion?
Well, it was great. It was great fun. You know, it was, it was good times. But it also spoke to, I was compelled to write it because I felt at odds with the reigning belief that unless you have a faith in God, you can't join a group. You can't really join a religious group. If you're a spiritual person, you may have religion in one respect, in that you commune with the Almighty, you commune with the Eternal, but you don't really join a community. And so you really have to kind of buy into one brand to commune. And that seemed, I don't know, unfortunate. And I wanted to give this person, this character of mine, the opportunity to commune with a group of people who may in fact be insane, but nevertheless are his.
So you're playing with this idea that you're sort of asking the question, is it a cult or is it a religion? Is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, to some extent, I'm trying to figure out what those differences are. It is raised explicitly in the book. And I think it's probably pretty easily dispatched in that the answer to it in the book is it's kind of a matter of critical mass. You know, at a certain point, you defer to the enormity of a group and call it a religion. But I also think an important distinction is that just as Christianity and Islam was rooted in the Hebrew Bible, this made-up religion is also rooted in the Hebrew Bible. And this borrowed interest goes a long way to legitimizing some new strain of thought. So it was really important to me not simply to create out of whole cloth some new cult, in part because the avowed atheist at the center of the book would not have bought into that, but to really root it in something that had a tradition of its own and that could be plausible. That way, I think, you call it a religion at that point. It has the dignity of a religion. And the character isn't just simply so desperate that he's following, you know, any old thinking into a dark alley.
Were you thinking about any particular religion that's come along that you were sort of basing this on?
I think probably the most, the religion that I found most fascinating in researching was Mormonism. The Fawn Brody book, No One Knows My History. No Man Knows My History? The Fawn Brody book, No Man Knows My History. I hope that's correct. That was a key book for me because it seems to be, at least from my reading of it, extremely objective about the man. And he created a religion. Now, whether or not it was divinely inspired is up for debate, but...
Joseph Smith, you're talking
Joseph
about.
Smith. And he ushered this enormous force of the 21st century into life, and willfully so and brilliantly so. And I was really captivated by that.
Now, the piece of the story in your novel is that a lot of this plays out on the internet.
Right.
Paul is sort of, first of all, he's outraged at the idea that his identity has been stolen. There's been this whole fabricated story about himself, you know, on his website, or not his website, but pretending to be his website. And then he gets kind of sucked in to the idea that about this strange religion, and he becomes sort of fascinated by it.
Yeah, I wanted to find out what the interstices were between religion as an ancient form and the internet as a novel communication tool. You know, where did they link up? What's possible in this brave new world of online exchanging with respect to these ancient ways of thinking? And so I was really interested in seeing how a religion might be created whole cloth on the internet. So that was a lot of fun for me, and part of the reason to write the book.
Do you think that could happen? I mean, having a religion basically created on the internet that would become viable in today's world?
I think you need some important elements that would really make it more viable. I think you need an origin story that people can believe. And I think you also need some kind of corollary between what's presented online and what exists in the world. Now, this could be very meager. I'm thinking of a tour that I did in Israel, in which the tour guide took us around and pointed to various intersections where there was basically nothing but two roads coming to a junction and a stop sign and, you know, some trash and rubble, and saying, well, this was the path where Elijah ascended into heaven.
So if you have, I mean, basically what you're saying is you need some, well, an origin story, but that has real emotional clout, and that kind of it's the basis for much that has followed.
Yeah, and you know, at the time that Joseph Smith was preaching the gospel of the Book of Mormon, there were a lot of other religions casting around for followers, and they've fallen away. It has to tap into something. It has to hit a nerve, and if it does, I think the internet is only going to facilitate the swiftness with which followers fall in line.
And yet my sense is that you yourself are kind of cynical about the internet in a way, that maybe there's something less real about what we read there, what we see there.
I would prefer to call it ambivalent. I think that there's a heck of a lot of information out there, and a lot of it is good, and some of it is bad. I think it very rarely rises to the level of knowledge, and almost never to the level of wisdom. And so I think that we can give people as much information as they want, but the use of that information can be dangerous in people who don't know how to think critically. And those critical thinking skills come from something other than the internet. I don't think the internet is a good way of teaching critical thinking skills. So we have to go somewhere else for that. We have to do that in an analog manner. So that's probably where my ambivalence comes from. And, you know, I mean, that ambivalence can slide into cynicism when I see it enacted in bad ways.
Do you intentionally try to limit how much time you spend doing things on the web?
I do. I mean, that's more of a practical concern. I would rather try to get work done or read books or something like that, or spend time with my family, whatever the case may be, than being online. But I also fail miserably, right? I mean, I am utterly seduced by this phenomenon, this terrific creation that has just bloomed in the last 10, 15 years that has changed everyone's lives. And I can't stay away from it. I mean, I looked at the celebrities today that have been denied any good roles since winning the Oscar. I can't stay away from that stuff. So I have to limit it just as a practical matter.
I mean, are you also concerned about, I don't know, a certain lack of authenticity on the internet? I mean, there's the sense that, and there is, it is the virtual world in a way, then, you know, maybe it threatens to replace what would seem more real in our actual physical world.
Well, I think a couple of things. I think one is that the person that's presenting him or herself online is so very well curated. So in terms of authenticity, I think you're putting your best foot forward to some extent. And it really kind of interferes or blocks out or just removes the messiness of the personality, right? And so I do miss the messiness online in the same in the way that we were sort of all scared of it around 2000. Like, what's going on out there, you know? But I don't really fear it. I just approach it with a degree of ambivalence.
Mm-hmm. How do you think about yourself as a novelist? If one were to put a label on you, comic novelist, novelist of ideas, how do you think about what you write?
I'm really bad to ask. I'm not the one to ask. I find myself interested in things as a human being, and then start trying them on as the novelist, and I'm just taken by different ideas, and they tend to take me in directions that leave behind the last book. They leave it far behind.
And so you want to write a different book?
I want to write a different book every time out. You bet.
Mm-hmm.
I would not know how to repeat myself, nor would I be interested, because I've already exhausted everything I have to say about the topic. And as such, I'm left spent with that thing and don't want to return to it. I have nothing more to add.
So, speaking of this book in particular, what was the seed of this book? I mean, what was the germination point that made you want to write this story?
When I went to college, I roomed with a guy who was from the northwest suburbs of Chicago. He was from Skokie. He was Jewish. He was the first Jewish guy I'd ever met, as far as I knew. We became best friends. And he, as a matter of fact, he's the fellow that I dedicated the book to. He inaugurated me to his family, to the Hillel, to the synagogue, to high holidays, to a Sabbath meal. And I really liked what I saw. And so what I wanted to write was not a book about the Jewish community or Judaism or a group of Jews who, you know, did this or that or the other thing, but what it was like to be an outsider looking in on a tight-knit group of Jews and wanting that kind of connection and not having it by a birthright and wondering what birthright might be his. That was the initial impulse.
Hmm. And also, what that means for the outsider, for you in that case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was crucial that it be an outsider because I really don't know anything about Judaism. I mean, a lot of the stuff in the book is just sort of made up or at least just sort of gathered in a bit of research. You know, the only thing that I really know with respect to any religion is what it's like to be on the outside.